Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 39. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Brian Giles of the band Red Fang, guitarist and vocalist for the Portland-based Relapse Records recording artists, who were one of the bands handpicked to play Metallica's Orion Music and More Festival back in 2012. Let's get right into it. Here's my conversation with Brian Giles of Red Fang. This is Speak and Destroy. Quote that I saw from you, you were talking about your love of pinball machines, which is something I share, and the quote was, sometimes they have machines backstage at festivals, and embarrassingly, I miss seeing a lot of my favorite bands because of them. At one festival, they had a Guns N' Roses pinball machine, and I skipped Duff McKagan's band to play his pinball machine, so I didn't feel too bad.
I did feel bad about that.
Dude.
It was free play, man. What can I do?
100% at Ryan Music, not the New Jersey one, but the Michigan one. Greg from the Dillinger Escape Plan and I skipped Metallica to keep playing Metallica pinball in the artist area.
Yeah, there
so
you go.
So it was literally
pretty much the same thing. Yeah.
I read that quote and I was like, I've literally done this exact thing. They were at least off in the distance, and we were hearing them as we were playing, but it was and the day before we had seen them do the Kill 'Em All set on the small stage, and I've seen them a million times, but nevertheless, I still feel weirdly guilty that we were not watching Metallica because we were playing Metallica pinball at Metallica's festival.
Oh yeah, I've done a lot of terrible. I mean, I think there was a catering was once you left catering, you couldn't go back, and there was free beer in there, so I was just like, well, I'm just gonna just have these beers, and ZZ Top was playing, and their set was mostly done anyway, but I was like, I had never seen ZZ Top, and I still haven't. That's even more embarrassing. It's freaking beer.
It's relatable, because I mean we must have the right intentions if we at least feel bad.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, I think the thing about, you know, you're touring or, you know, these festivals, if you're sort of inundated by bands, there's so much going on. It's like you almost get apoplectic trying to catch all the bands. And so sometimes you really do just need to take some time to yourself. And I think that's one of the things I like about pinball. I'm in a pinball club, you know, so and I actually played some pinball with one of my club members last night, which was super fun. But in general, I think one of the things I like about pinball is that it's sort of a zen thing, and that you're just, it's just you and the machine, you know, and you can focus in there, and that it's an actual thing instead of screen time. You know, it's you're staring at something, but at least it's a real thing.
Yeah, there's physical, tangible things moving around in front of you.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what I enjoy about it too, if you're kind of pro and conning it relative to, say, a video game, whether it's an old school video game or a current one. What I like about pinball is it's very linear and very sort of, I'm not obsessive about solving any puzzle or achieving any, you know, getting past some plateau or whatever. It's like I can really just play pinball and just play it till my quarters run out and start over,
yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. I'm pretty into it. So, there are machines, you know, some machines are deeper than others, but you know, there's, you know, modes and things you have to, you know, things you do have to achieve, that kind of thing. And I can really get into that too.
I could see that. Yeah.
But I can also just walk up to a machine I've never played before. And I'm not so nerdy that I read the directions before I play it. I'll just put some quarters in and just see what happens. You know, if it's fun, and exactly just do it for the sheer joy of it, you know.
So tell me, as a pinball connoisseur and Metallica fan both, where does the Stern Pinball Metallica machine rank in the in the greater context of pinball in general? Like, is it good? Is it mediocre? Is it average? Is it awesome? I probably don't know enough about pinball to really. And also, I'm biased because it's Metallica. So
right, right. Well, I'm certainly no expert either, but to me, I think it's a fun game. There's enough going on. I think some pinball machines, like I think the modern, like Iron Man or something like that, it's a little too, redundant and also irritatingly like they on Iron Man, they have one of the bad guys is up front and he's got this really strong magnet. And if you hit him, it just goes fucking bonkers. And there's really nothing you can do to defend against it. And so it's just kind of a quarter eater. Whereas,
yeah,
at least, Metallica has some things going on as far as modes and things you have to do to clear out. And also if you spend time on it, you can stay alive for a long time. If you only have $1.50 in quarters, you can still make an hour out of it, So,
yeah, that's good to hear. Yeah. I think being able to, quarter eater, that's a great point. Some modern games do seem so over the top and so many figurative and literal bells and whistles that it's just annihilating you within a few seconds. And it's like, well, this was a cool spectacle, but it wasn't fun.
Exactly. I like the new ones with TVs on the back glass, but it is irritating to me nowadays. It seems intentional that basically if they're like, all right, now your mode is to do this, but you have to look at the screen to see what's happening, like what lane to shoot or what ramp to shoot next. And looking at the back glass is an easy way to lose a ball, And so like some of them, like Star Wars, I like to say that I won't play that one unless I'm hanging out with a friend of mine who can read me the screen. So I have to do both. It's like, man, it's like, sure, I'd love to watch the graphics, but I'm doing something down here,
It's like the Millennium Falcon. Like, you need an engineer and a gunner and a co-pilot to help you. If you're walking into an establishment with a wide array of pinball machines, an arcade, a pinball place, a bar that's super into it, what are your go-tos? Like, what are you looking for when you're making a beeline for the machines?
Mostly it's, cause I'm a sort of a hermit when I'm at home. I kind of stick to my neighborhood. So there's only, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 machines that I play on a regular basis. Cause I'm sort of out of town, but get classic games, not necessarily classic, but just games that I just don't see all the time, or games that I've really loved playing in the past that I'm like, ooh, that one, I don't ever see that one. Like, I don't know, Creature of the Black Lagoon or Tales of the Arabian Nights, some of those. I was just at this new pinball bar here in Portland. They've got like 20 pins and they have the new Black Knight, which is also, I was very excited about that one. It's kind of a mix. It's just the novelty of something that I haven't seen in a long time.
A good friend of mine recently, within the last year or so, purchased a Freddy Krueger pinball machine and has been...
Oh, I've never played that one. How is it?
It's awesome. I haven't played one in a long time. I haven't played his because, unfortunately, him and I live, an hour away from each other. I played one a long time ago. A friend of mine in Indianapolis, where I grew up, had one for a long time. And it's awesome. It's got, a lot of cool functionality, especially for that era, in terms of, little props and gizmos that are inside there.
Is it like a late 80s one, or is it some like kind of retrospective of the whole movie series?
That's a good question, because I feel like it's Dream Warriors oriented. I could be misremembering that.
Right, so that's early 90s, I think. No, well, Dream Warriors, let's see.
That's 80s, I can't remember. For sure,
I went to a buddy of mine and I, we were... When I was a kid, we were really into the Freddy Krueger series, so we showed up to we showed up to one of those movies. Like, I want to say maybe it was four. It was a kind of a, it was a disappointing one, but we went to the theater covered in blood, fake blood. To be clear, fake blood, people. Yeah.
That's gnarly.
And then I was like, that movie wasn't very good, and now I'm really sticky.
I just looked it up, and it was the machine came out in 94. So I guess it would have been.
So it featured like elements from the first few movies.
Yeah. You know, it's a funny story about that is I was so into Freddy as a kid. You know, when the first movie was out, I saw it in the theaters. I was probably a little too young to have seen it, but my older brother helped me dress up as Freddy Krueger that Halloween. And it was before there weren't commercially available Freddy costumes. Like, it wasn't like a thing that people were doing yet. So it was literally like all homemade. Like, we made a little cardboard blades for the glove and, you know, got some like theater makeup and tried to approximate a burned up face. And you couldn't even find like a red and green sweater anywhere.
That's funny. John, our drummer, he had a sweater, which we called his Freddy sweater. And it was just spot on. It was amazing.
There's something about, and of course I'm misremembering it now, but there's something about red and green together that causes some sort of issue for people vision wise, which is why it's not commonly a color that you're going to see like the Freddy sweater.
I'm not sure. I haven't heard that specifically about red and green, but I think they're complementary colors. I think they're on the opposite ends of the spectrum so that it makes your eyes wiggle a little bit to have like orange and blue next to each other is also kind of intense.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was intentional.
Yeah, totally. Right.
It's like, what's the ugliest sweater we could put this guy in?
There you go. That's going to like hurt your eyes to look at.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was a big fan of those films. Still am. And
I'm your boyfriend now, Tina. Jeez, Louise. Did they maybe not want to answer the phone for a while?
Totally. Or take a bath.
Or go to sleep, brother.
Yeah, I went to go see Freddy's Dead: The Final Nightmare by myself, and that wasn't necessarily a good one. But that was the one, if you remember, where.
I didn't even see that one. I fell off the series because I think that, like, well, Dream Warriors, I thought was just like, what? You really, they're jumping the shark already on this one. It's just like ridiculous. So maybe that might have been the last one. Well, no, I think I saw some of Freddy versus Jason in space or whatever, whatever that one was. They fought in a movie, right?
They did. I actually visited the set of that movie. I think
they did. I don't know.
No, they did.
Or at least I know there was Jason in space, right? That was that's a jump the shark.
Yeah, that was Jason X.
Spaceship with Jason in it.
Yeah, that was Jason X. There's been a Jason in space. There's been a Leprechaun in space. There's been Hellraiser in space. I'm probably forgetting a few. A bunch of horror franchises eventually go to space when they can't figure out what to do next.
Yep, it's the jump the shark for horror, that's for sure.
For sure. I actually, once upon a time, I was a reporter for MTV News, and I actually did a visit to the set of Freddy vs. Jason.
And, oh, yeah, that's rad.
Yeah, I spent the whole day with Robert Englund, and yeah, it was badass.
Nice guy.
He's fantastic. And he's like he's got that sort of like classically trained theater actor vibe, where it's like, you know, he's iconically forever intertwined with this horror movie icon franchise character, and yet he's like this super sharp, kind of little bit arty guy. Been super funny.
Yeah. Well, I've heard, this is awful because, and this is probably telling of the whole idea is that, you know, Booger from Better Off Dead?
Yes, of course.
Well, apparently I've heard that he's a fairly serious actor, or started out that way, but then just got typecast as Booger. I mean, I think he's still doing it in American Dad. I think he's a voice of essentially Booger. And that I don't know his name, and I think of him as Booger. It's like, I hope that it doesn't make him too sad. I mean, it's certainly he's made a career out of it, but he probably didn't go into acting school thinking, I can't wait to be an unctuous loser for the rest of my life.
A nervous, idiosyncratic, irritating. Yeah, in fact, to your point, you know, you said Better Off Dead, and I knew who you meant immediately because, you know, what's, do you know the street value of this mountain?
Exactly.
And yet Booger was the name of his character in Revenge of the Nerds, which...
Oh, whoops. Yeah.
No, which fully supports your point that he's essentially playing a variation of the same character movie after movie and...
Yeah, he's still Booger. He just had a different name.
Gosh, what? I want to say Moonlighting. I think he was on Moonlighting, Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd.
You mean as a recurring character?
Yeah, I think he was like a main character on that show, you know, other than those two.
Wow. And I actually watched Moonlighting. I'm not sure how cool that is, but
I did too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, back in those days, you couldn't watch, you know, C-SPAN 3 and watch sumo wrestling or whatever. You kind of were, it was either that or PBS or something. You're like, no.
Yeah. And he was in, One Crazy Summer as another, you know, Booger-esque character.
Jean jacket or jean or denim vest wearing no good Nick.
Yeah, it's funny. He's like you said, his thing is being like a serious actor. And Dolph Lundgren, who I'm a huge fan of, you know, who is thought of as, you know, a lunk-headed, super buff action hero villain guy. He's like an MIT graduate and speaks multiple languages and he's a super brilliant genius.
But he was the one, he fought Rocky, right?
Yeah.
He's the, I will crush you.
That's him. Yeah.
Brainless Russian, who apparently is not brainless at all.
Not at all. And English isn't his first language, but he speaks with almost no accent in everyday life.
So he had to undo that, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know that, I mean, not to talk about myself, but I mean, our videos are very, a lot of them are beer oriented. So. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of that where I think that forever and ever I'm drinking a beer right now. Okay. That being said, it's like, that's pretty much what people think of me. It's like, I'm just the beer guy.
Right.
Like, man, I'm not just a beer guy.
You're like,
I have so much more to offer.
Let's have a beer and talk about it.
Exactly.
That rules. So yeah. So Metallica, I also read somewhere how For Whom the Bell Tolls was a quintessential sort of gateway song for you in general. Tell me a little bit about that and tell me about young Brian and what some of your first musical discoveries were and when you started to hear things where you were like, oh, music's going to be a big part of my life.
I think, you know, for me, music was always a big part because my mother she sang in like a choir in college and was always playing piano in the house, and she had music on pretty much all the time. So, you know, I mean, I wasn't listening to like super rad. Well, I mean, I like it still, but whatever. Like, I don't know, like, what's that song? Betty Davis Eyes.
Yeah.
Who was that?
She's got Betty Davis
Eyes. Kim Carnes. Yes.
Kim Carnes. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, stuff like that. And I just picked up, Xanadu on vinyl.
Dude, I saw Xanadu in the theater. I'm showing my age, but yeah, my mom took me to see Xanadu.
That's amazing. I wish I had. Yeah. anyway, so that sort of thing. I think like she listened to, you know, a lot of folk stuff like James Taylor, stuff like that. Anyway, so, you know, I'd be playing with my, you know, Tonka truck or whatever. But there was always music on in the background. So I think I was always sort of singing melodies as a kid. And I think another thing that, I remember distinctly is that, she would run the dishwasher before bed. So I'd be going to sleep. And if I had trouble sleeping, I would just listen to the dryer. And it would have this arrhythmic clunking sound. Mm-hmm. So, but I would make up rhythms and I would pick them out. And so I was basically constantly making rhythms out of the, you know, the craziness of
ambient
the dryer.
Noise.
Yeah, exactly.
You're making rhythms and you're also teaching yourself unwittingly meditation techniques.
Yeah. I mean, it worked better than counting sheep. You know, I mean, yeah. I wasn't really good at math. So, you know, it was easier than doing that. But anyway, so I guess I was sort of predisposed to, you know, be keyed in on music. And my, you know, I have an older brother and he got into hard rock, and the first couple albums he turned me on to was like Van Halen, Fair Warning, and ZZ Top, Eliminator, I think. Anyway, I was pretty taken by that. I was like, wow, I didn't realize that, you know, this was out there, because I was a little bit sheltered. Other than hearing Black Sabbath on the Wolfman Jack show on my alarm clock radio and thinking Satan was coming out of the speakers, I was literally afraid of it. I don't know, it was probably 9 or 10. I was like, ah,
yeah,
scary. But anyway, once, you know, he turned me onto that stuff, and then I was just hooked, and I think that it just kind of took off from there. His taste in music and mine diverged. He got into really heavy, gnarly metal, and I was kind of leaning more towards punk rock, that kind of thing.
Oh, but, interesting. Yeah, my older siblings are so crucial, and I've my older brother, who's 5 years older than me. When I was very young, he was responsible for getting me into Adam and the Ants and Hanoi Rocks. He showed me Hanoi Rock, you know, some stuff that I still love. But yeah, at a certain point, we diverged where, yeah, he was more into the hair metal thing for a minute, and I was never really into that. And I got into, you know, thrash and punk and hardcore and all of that. And then as adults, I mean, we've come back around full circle on certain things, but he's now very into, I don't know if you describe it as roots rock, but, you know, stuff that's kind of more on that a little twangier side of, of rock, I guess. Leon Russell was like a big hero of his. I'm always fascinated by, you know, what kind of music was around the house for people that grow up to do bands, and then also, you know, siblings, only children, and how, you know, because that stuff's so crucial.
You know, yeah, well, and also, you know, I mean, definitely, I think, you know, music is a way to, you know, create your identity, because you don't really have a whole lot going on. You know what I mean? You're in, you know, junior high. What can you really say that sets you apart from anybody else, other than like, oh, I have break first period or whatever, you know? So you want to be somebody. Well, then say, you know, you get your, you know, rock t-shirt or whatever, and you're like, all right, this is me or whatever. It's like, yeah, well, no, it's not. That's actually, you just helped out a band. You're not really that, but whatever, you know.
I never thought about it that way. That's a great point, though. Sort of like, even in the sort of almost the more iconoclastic and nonconformist that you are at that age, the more sort of basic you are. Because you're trying to carve out an identity for yourself, and so you're looking for something that's going to stand out and be unique. That's a great way to look at it. It's true.
This was my first day of high school. I think I saw my first metal concert that summer. I was Dio for Sacred Heart.
Dude, anyway, Dio was my first metal concert. High five.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Rad. What tour?
It was Dio, Megadeth, and Sabotage, 1988. And I, truth be told, as much as I love Dio now and share a middle name and initials with him, I went for Megadeth. At the time, I wasn't as hip to Dio. And Sabotage canceled for some reason. They were on the bill, but they did not perform. But, yeah, legendary show. I want to say that was for Dio, Dream Evil.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, still have my Megadeth shirt from that show, actually. It doesn't necessarily fit, but...
Well, you can't get rid of it.
But I know.
My wife keeps trying to get me to get rid of t-shirts. My t-shirt drawer is essentially 99% black band t-shirts.
Yeah.
But you know, and I don't wear probably 90% of them, but they're, you know, they're keepsakes for me. I'm like, well, I just can't do it.
Absolutely.
Whatever that show is, you know, it's like they bring me joy. So
get rid of it if it doesn't bring you joy. This brings me joy, damn it. I need to open this drawer and smell crusty screen print from decades
exactly.
ago.
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, so the first day of high school, I went and I wore my Dio shirt and a pair of like their like really long floral print jams shorts.
Amazing.
And anyway, I thought I was pretty cool. But so I was a freshman, and there was, you know, some, you know, older kid, sophomore, junior or something, on the bus was like, "What's this? What are you, a surfer or a meddler? Figure it out and it was like really shitty to me. I'm got thin skin, so I was like, oh no. So pretty much my whole freshman year, all I wore was cut off jean shorts, black chucks, and plain shirts. I was like, I do not want to be identified by anything because someone will notice. So I was just,
oh man,
I was like, I'm going to keep it to myself. I don't want to get judged. But then I grew out of it and, you know, got a mohawk and all this stupid shit, but you know, I was like, no, I am this, whatever. But for it kind of stunted me a little bit as far as my fashion.
Yeah, dude. I mean, what a torturous, brutal, ritualistic haze that middle school and high school were. I like to think that kids have it a little better now for all of the failings and criticisms that abound. Did you ever see the 21 Jump Street movie?
The modern one or
the modern one with Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill?
Yes, I think, but it did not sink in. I think it was just like surface yucks, and now it's just fallen out of my brain completely. Oh, well,
what makes me think about it is, you know, so Jonah Hill was a nerd in high school, and Channing Tatum was super cool, jock, popular guy. And then when they go back to high school now, undercover, being a good-looking jock who's not that bright makes you a loser, and being like Jonah Hill makes you super cool. And it's, I don't know, it's just funny. Like,
right, right.
You know, the popular kid is like gay, and this other kid is, you know, like the drug dealer is cool. And, yeah.
Yeah. And I think I recall they were, you know, talking about having a backpack on two shoulders was the nerdiest thing ever. But then they get there and everyone's wearing a backpack the way it's meant to be.
Exactly.
Worn.
So I like to think that there's been some correction that's happened that's made it a little less hellish for kids than it was for us. But
I don't know. You know what? I kind of have to disagree with you. I think it's exactly as bad. It's just not bad in the same way that as we experienced it. I mean, I think, well, and not to get too deep into politics or anything, but it does seem like the ideologies, because of the internet and, you know, the hyper connectivity these kids have, it's, you know, the thought police is on patrol, man.
Yeah.
It's like if you say something too left, you say something too right, it's like you're constantly being judged, trolled, that kind of thing. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, the amount of dumb things that I did when I was a kid, if they were recorded on the internet, I would lose my shit. You know what I mean?
Thankful every day that I didn't have YouTube when I was first trying to do music, or, you know, like imagine YouTube videos of like your first jam sesh or something.
Exactly.
Or
yeah.
Let alone, you know, talking into your camera on MySpace or something. Like, I just, I'm glad I don't have that stuff floating around out there.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's gonna, I mean, that's constantly evolving, but right now I think it's in a pretty, the kids are in a pretty precarious place as far as, you know, like people getting hazed on the internet. I mean, I'm sure there's got to be teen suicides that are caused by someone just, you know, someone catching an embarrassing moment.
Oh, definitely.
Some kid at school, and then they just post it, and then the entire school is, you know, resharing, and they're the laughingstock for the school for something that maybe one person could, you know, have like tell the story, but ever like, oh, I don't believe it. But now it's just like there's proof of everything. You are exposed all the time. It's real 1984, man. I wouldn't like it. I mean, I personally don't have a Facebook, you know, pay, well, I do, but I haven't looked at it in like 3 years. I just, that whole element of your hyper exposure, especially for young people that haven't really figured out who they are yet. You know, like I was saying, it's like, I don't know who I am yet. So I'm not going to wear any kind of clothes that identify me as one thing or another. You can't really get away with that anymore because you will be put in a box on, you know, publicly. It's ugh.
Yeah. And like you said, with the thought police being out in full force and that being such a crucial time of experimentation and figuring things out and solidifying who you are and where your values are and what separates you from your parents and who your social group's going to be, to be under such heightened and very public, as you said, scrutiny right now as you're going through that. Yeah, that's it, as much as I was kind of celebrating some of the things that used to be stigmatized that are now accepted. Yeah, you're absolutely right. On the flip side, you're on the world stage almost immediately, under a microscope as you're, you know, fidgeting around in the dark trying to feel things out. Yeah, and it's gonna discourage the natural types. You know, I go back and forth because like this recent YouTube purge that happened, you know, just in the last few days as we're taping this podcast. On the one hand, yeah, absolutely, I love cleaning up the interwebs from stuff that's, you know, radicalizing people and creating mass shooters. And on the flip side, I'm such a, fewer values are as important to me as free speech and liberty. And, you know, I like to think that we should be able to take in all the information and discern it and draw our own conclusions, and that all the information, even really bad ideas, should be available. And it's the responsibility of people with the better ideas to highlight those and deconstruct them or destroy them. So I have this kind of, you know, and it's such a slippery slope. It's like, you know, one minute it's the Burzum YouTube channel, but then what, you know, what's going to qualify as something that must be banished, you know, next week. If it's easy when it's something that's easier to agree upon for everyone, but then what happens when it's that much worse? So anyway, I guess my point there is I feel like kids need to, and young adults even, need to have some leeway, some freedom to have bad ideas, you know, and
yeah, absolutely,
and,
yeah,
and then have them challenged, you know, and kind of figure it out. But yeah, so I have no answer to that question, but it's something.
No, well, you know, I think it's something for the kids to figure out. I mean, it's the next generations, you know, I mean, they're the ones who are making it, you know. It's their world, they're building it, and so they've got to find their pitfalls. And I just feel like right now there's a shitload of pitfalls, so
yeah,
which I just worry about, you know. And this is going to sound shitty, but like the thing that concerns me, and this happens not just with, say, Me Too movement, but the court of public opinion, and you know, I'm playing devil's advocate like crazy, but like,
sure,
I don't know anyone, even like R. Kelly or whatever. It's just like, obviously, he seems obviously guilty, you know, to me. But it's like, but he was made guilty by the internet way before there was a court case. It's like, okay, there does seem to be overwhelming evidence, and I'm looking at it. But then again, as far as, you know, that documentary, but it's like, but this hasn't been looked at by, you know, a jury of his peers, you know. And I just feel like, you know, a lot of people like, what's that guy's name? A Democrat from, I think, what is it, Minnesota?
Al
comedian,
Franken. Al Franken, yeah.
That he basically, you know, just so that, you know, he didn't want to be, you know, two-faced about the whole thing. So he was like, okay, well, yeah, okay, I'm gonna resign because of these accusations. But there was no court case there. There was no actual guilt. There was just someone leveled a claim at him. And because of the world says, okay, yeah, you're guilty. But it's like, all right, but where does that end? You know, I mean, are people...
Yeah, and it's also interesting when people like Al Franken could sort of allow themselves to be held to that higher standard and come forward and offer contrition, and then they get blasted 10 times harder. Whereas you have somebody like, you know, Roy Moore, the child molester that was running for elected office, and just denying and lying about it. It seems like then you're allowed to kind of keep cruising. I would say, devil's advocate wise too, you know, as you said, you know, someone like R. Kelly or Michael Jackson or whatever being tried in the court of public opinion, on the devil's advocate side, on the other direction, I sometimes am concerned that there is so much information available that now, you know, the whole idea of the court system being proving something beyond a reasonable doubt, reasonable doubt is now being introduced into everything. And that's where we're ending up with, you know, a president that can say, I don't know, maybe it was Russia, maybe it was China, maybe it was a 400-pound guy on his bed. And that's sort of like our new attitude about everything. You know, like, I don't know, but maybe not. Maybe the earth is flat, you know, and it's like overwhelming evidence that the earth is round, but oh, maybe it's flat, you know. Like,
yeah, there's flat earthers at all. It's just mind-blowing to
absolutely.
Me.
Yeah, and I actually yeah. found out just a couple of days ago that I'm an acquaintance of mine is a bona fide flat earther, and it's really shocking when you put a face on it, and when it's like, that's a human being I've interacted with who seems like a reasonable, normal person, and is full on flat earth.
And but you get along with this person in other respects?
Yeah, I wouldn't even say that we're friends. It's more of a acquaintance. But yeah, still, even just finding that out was like, woof. Wow.
So crazy. It's like, man, it's like, dude, man, oh, whatever. I can't. It's
and that
crazy.
Does make, and that does give me a little bit of, you know, yeah, scrub every flat earth video off YouTube because look what's happened. But
no, they're incredibly entertaining. I mean, someone's like, well, look, we're in a plane. You can see the edge of the earth. It's flat. You're like, oh, yeah. All right, man.
Well, on the Varg thing, just to kind of bring it to our little, you know, extreme music subculture, whatever you want to call it. Of course, you know, no reasonable person supports Varg Vikernes or his terrible ideas. That doesn't mean that I haven't been entertained by them from time to time.
Right, yeah. It takes all kinds.
I have watched his dumb videos, you know, like, so, yeah. And again, the liberty and free speech part of me goes like, man, all of the bad ideas should be available. I would just hope that the force of the better ideas is enough to win a fair fight. You know, let's keep a level playing field with all these platforms, but I don't know.
Yeah. It's just really interesting these days. I mean, you know, I was just, you know, watching a Samantha Bee episode and, mm-hmm.
Love
and
her.
They were showing that to that TV or that, basically they can mimic people. Like they can basically take someone's face and put it on someone else's face and basically make a video of someone saying anything they want to.
Yeah.
And voice mimicry is not far behind. So really, as far as this whole fake news thing goes, soon it will be so hard to tell what is real and what is fake. You can't just say, well, look, I'm looking at a video of this politician saying this thing. It's like, well, but that might not be real, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Who knows? I mean, I mean, where are we going to get our actual, you know, factual information? You know, once the internet has grown to the size that basically it eclipses, you know, CNN or any or Fox or any other news agency, and it's just people out there making up, you know, fake realities. And you're being yeah. assaulted by them on a daily basis. I mean, how do you even navigate that? I mean, I don't think it's going to be. I don't foresee in my lifetime. I mean, I'm getting on 50, so you know, I don't really see this dystopian future that I'm sort of envisioning really affecting me as much as you know millennials. But they've got a tough road ahead, man. Reality's being mutated. It's like, it's scary to me.
I remember having a conversation with two friends of mine when Osama bin Laden was killed, and one of my friends said, well, you know, I don't know if I believe that they actually killed him. I mean, there's no photos of the body, and it's convenient that they did a burial at sea, and you know, who knows if that's just, if that's propaganda or whatever. And then the other friend says, I don't know if I believe Osama bin Laden ever existed. And we're like, wait, what? You know? And he's like, yeah, I mean, that could just be an actor and a boogeyman that's been created by our government. And then I rewind even further back, as a teenager in my local metal and hardcore scene in the late 80s and early 90s, we had a little bit of a Nazi skinhead problem, which I think was not uncommon in the scene at that time. And I remember having an argument with two Nazi skinheads once, and you know, they were doing the Holocaust denial thing that Nazi skinheads are prone to do. And, you know, my immediate response is to say there is there are volumes of documentation that that is a historical fact. And I was like, there's film, you can watch it. And those guys saying to me, and this was in like the late 80s, early 90s, those guys said, yeah, you can also watch Star Wars. That looks pretty real. So
yeah,
it's terrifying that it's getting closer and closer. We're probably already there, right, to be able to completely fake something. But on the flip side, it's also very dangerous that we've, you know, whether it's the moon landing, like, you know, there's so many things that already have been, when there's so much doubt thrown around and we can't agree upon a certain set of facts, you know, three friends having a conversation where one's going, hey, did you hear they killed bin Laden? And the second friend says, I don't know if I believe they did that. And the third one says, I don't know if I believe he existed. It's like, where do you, what are we even talking about then? You know, like.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I remember one of my favorite movies I saw when I was a kid was Capricorn One. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so, you know, and I think movies are a reflection of the anxieties of the time. And so, I mean, that movie probably came out in what, the late 70s, early 80s. And I think that was something that was on people's minds even way back then. I totally agree. And you know, if you,
that movie also has O.J. Simpson in it.
Oh,
speaking of reasonable doubt.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah. But yeah, it's real scary. I mean, that was something we really worried about back then. And now I feel like, people are using it, that anxiety or that, you know, people's doubting what they're told and manipulating people into just believing whatever they say. Because like you say, it's like, you're talking to some guys like, you know, you got three people and one of them thinks that Osama bin Laden, you know, wasn't killed. The other one thinks doesn't exist. So now, you know, and like I say, I hate talking politics, but I mean, not these days, you know, it's like, I feel like the current administration, is capitalizing on that in a major way and in a very effective way. I mean, as much as I dislike a lot of their policies, most of them, truth be told, but they're very good at adjusting people's or communicating to people through on an emotional level, and casting doubt on reality because it forwards their means. And you know, you can whatever side of the fence you sit on, you gotta hats off to these guys for somehow. It's just incredible, and it's just concerning that is so effective. And I'm not saying that right wingers are the only ones who are doing it. It's, you know, it's a tactic, and it's disingenuous, but it's so effective that you got to be like, oh well, yeah, it's working for you.
Yeah, there was a reporter, I think maybe she was in Pittsburgh or something like that, but there was a reporter who had this quote where she said, you know, that liberals, I'm paraphrasing, but basically that conservatives take Trump seriously, but not literally, and liberals take him literally, but not seriously. And it's like, yeah, I mean, that sums up a lot of that divide. And I think, yeah, as you said, it's a very effective propaganda tool, and not just to single out the current administration and the United States, but historically speaking, when you can cause people to be so overwhelmed by the flood of information and the contradictory and, you know, the battles of the different viewpoints. And if you can get everyone to doubt reality and the set of agreed upon facts, and it's much easier to get people to just give up and stop paying attention altogether. Cause it's like, I don't know, who knows, whatever. And then, you know,
right. Yeah.
And then you win.
And it's just basically just speaking to people's emotions instead of their intellect. And that seems to be where people would rather be, you know, in general. So,
yeah. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of, you know, I feel like a lot of politics right now are a lot of people going, you like that? You like that? Take that. You like that? You like that? Like a lot of this weird retaliatory sort of, you know, well, I used to, I felt like you looked down on me, so now I look down on you. I gotcha. You
know, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it used to. I mean, it when I was growing up, it felt like there. I mean, there was still, you know, people, you know, jabbing each other on, you know, below the belt. But it just seemed like it had so much more decorum, and now it's just like, it's like what it's like fucking. Theater, it's bullshit.
It is all like theater, bullshit, yeah. You know? And it used to also have the vibe that, you know, the whole thing of like, I can talk shit about my dad, but if you say something about my dad, we're gonna fight. It used to kind of have that vibe, and now that's, you know, if you remember, obviously the huge controversy and scandal when one of the Dixie Chicks said something very mild about the president while overseas on foreign soil, and now we literally have a president who's sitting in front of grave markers, you know, on the anniversary of D-Day, trashing his political opponents. And it's just like, that's where we are now, I guess.
Right. That is not the forum for that behavior. You know,
No. It's
like people died so that you could stand there and say whatever you want. But I don't think that was the point of him doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And then
you're literally standing on the bodies of people who died because it was so important for, you know, to maintain, you know, people's right to, you know, to liberty, and you're going to use it to be a dick. All right, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It's just it is the age of the troll right now, for sure.
Yeah.
So, you know who never gets political is Metallica. They have there's definitely some differing political views within that band, and I think they've done a great job. They've done a good job of, without compromising, that there's different people in the band with different views. They don't really, they seem very careful to make sure they don't alienate anyone in their audience.
Right. Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, I generally don't speak about politics at all because, my views don't, reflect
your whole band or your audience, of course.
But these days, it's just like, to me, it's like, look, man, you can't sit on the fence at this point. You really, it's just ridiculous. Anyway, but I respect other people's viewpoints. I'm not saying that I'm right and they're wrong. It's just,
I don't think you come off that way at all. I think this is also kind of part of the thought police is that we're, cause I'm like you and I avoid these conversations for the most part, especially within a public platform, like a podcast even, but by the same turn, we shouldn't have to be afraid to, that someone's going to
express your opinion. You have an opinion, express it.
But that's how severe the divide is that if you even sound like you're, because I don't consider myself part of, you know, any political party. But if you say the wrong thing, that's going to incite someone on either side of that spectrum. Suddenly they're canceling you. You're canceled.
Right. Sure. I mean, here's an example. We don't do anything political really on our social media, mm-hmm. but we did make an exception because our friend Herbie from Thor, our valiant Thor, he and some friends did a GoFundMe for supplies for the South Dakota oil line thing. So anyway, and it was very successful. They filled like, I don't know, a bunch of vans full of like food and warm clothes and tents and camping supplies and stuff and sent them up there because people were in extreme weather conditions trying to protect their land. And it was something they believed in. So anyway, they contacted us and said, do you mind reposting this? And we all decided, and we're like, no, man, that's humanitarian. It's not even political.
Right.
It's just these people, these are Americans doing something they believe in and we don't want them to suffer and or die from, you know, the exposure. So this is not even political. This is humanitarian. So anyway, mm-hmm. we posted it. Anyway, well, here come the trolls. You know, I mean, there were comments like, oh, I knew you fucking, I can't believe Red Fang's a bunch of fucking snowflakes, whatever, blah, blah. I'm so glad I never paid for a song. I'm glad I pirated all your music. I'm never listening to you again. I'm like, whoa, because we don't want people to die, then we're the pariahs. It's just crazy. You know what I mean? So yeah, wading in these days, oof, it can get nasty.
It can get nasty really fast. And especially if you don't, conform to a cookie cutter caricature on either side of what you're supposed to think, you know, whatever your team is for in the team sports. And
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and I often find myself in conversations where I'm too much of this for somebody, but not enough of this. You know, it's like, yeah. So, for whom the bell tolls.
Right, full circle.
Where did you first hear that? Was that an older brother moment, or did that come somewhere else?
Yeah, I guess, I think my brother bought the cassette. I remember listening to it on our boombox, and I got to that song. The first time I'd ever listened to the album, and I was, you know, I mean, just the sound of it all the way around, just everything about it, the production value, just how aggressive it was. It was it transported you to some kind of weird new place that I was like, this is amazing. But I got to that song, and that bass solo intro is just mesmerizing to me. I'm like, oh my God. Well, I didn't realize that it was a bass thing. I thought it was a guitar thing for years until I saw a live video. I'm like, oh my God, it's Cliff Burton. That's amazing. But I rewound that song like three times before I could even move on to the next track, because I was like, that is the best song I've ever heard. It was so, it just blew me away.
That whole idea of being transported that you described, that's such a crucial thing to me about Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets in particular, you know, whether it's Orion or Call of Cthulhu, where there's, you know, there aren't vocals, obviously, or something like Ride the Lightning or Creeping Death, like, they really, you know, took my young mind and took me places, you know, like they're cinematic, you know?
I agree completely. Yeah. It's you can close your eyes and listen to that stuff and you can be on, you know, a different planet, different plane, you know, I think that's the beauty of, you know, good music. It doesn't have to be heavy metal or whatever, but you know, whatever you're doing, if it can take you somewhere else. I mean, I think that, well, for me, probably music was an escapism thing. And so I guess maybe I was looking for the most effective escapism I could find. And I think I found it in that album. And still to this day, I hear it, you know, I put it on and it's just as good as when I first listened to it.
Absolutely. And Ride the Lightning has a song on it literally called Escape. So
there you go. Yeah, yeah.
Which they didn't play they never played it live until recent years. I think Hetfield hates that song, if I remember that.
Oh, yeah.
My Metallica lore correctly. When was the first time that you saw them play?
First time I saw them play was probably 1989, maybe. Some people can fact check me. They can troll me if they want. But they were opening for Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh, that might have been 86, actually.
It was Ozzy, but yeah, I mean, I don't know if my parents would let me go in 86. That would have been 13, possible.
Let me ask you this. Was it Cliff or Newstead?
It was, oh God, I believe it was Cliff Burton, I believe.
Then it had to be 86.
It was, I think it was Ultimate Sin Tour.
It was definitely 86.
Okay. Well,
each new anecdote, I'm like, okay, yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, I mean, you know, at least somebody's got to know what's going on. I'm Captain Vague. But I remember the thing about that is, like, we were really excited because I guess they were touring on I think it was Master of Puppets is what they were playing.
And they toured Puppets from, you know, it was like early 86 into early 87. Because they jumped right back in with both feet with Newstead and continue, you know, I think they went to Japan was the first tour with him. But that was, that would have been 86.
Yeah. The story that I like to tell about that was that it was my brother and his buddy Eric and I were going to the show, and anyway, we get to the place and it's a good half an hour drive from our house, and we get there and my brother realizes he's left the tickets at home.
Well, there's no iPhone to pull up the PDF.
Oh no. So we just got back in the car And my brother drove on residential streets 80 miles an hour the whole way. It was the most death-defying. I was like, oh my God, it's not worth dying over. I mean, I was really bummed that we were going to miss Metallica, but I think my brother was even more so because he's like, well, put your seatbelts on because I may kill you trying to see this band. But we made it. We saw the whole set. It was fucking tight. We walked in and they'd start. So
that rules. Anyway. And they had and they had the production too, right? Where they had like the crosses on stage, and it's kind of, you know, knowing what you know about being in a touring band now, it always kind of blows my mind that, you know, Ozzy had an opening band that had all that stage production. And like, because, you know, now it's like you guys get 6 inches on stage and you got to sell your t-shirts for $40 like we do. And
you get half the PA power.
You get half the PA power. No backdrop. Yeah. Or you get to hang your postage stamp backdrop in the middle of our gargantuan backdrop.
Right. Yes. I remember seeing Motorhead open for Slayer, and Motorhead was really quiet. And I was like, man, this is bullshit. Because I was as excited to see Motorhead as Slayer. I mean, I love Slayer, but...
I bet we saw that same tour. Was that Slayer, Motorhead, and Overkill?
That sounds right. I saw them, and that was definitely 89.
Yeah, I bet that would be the tour, because I saw them in 88, and it was Slayer, Motorhead, and Overkill. I think one part of that tour might have been Slayer, Motorhead, and the Cro-Mags. But when it came to my tour, it was Overkill. I actually just had Bobby the Blitz from Overkill on this podcast.
Oh, no shit.
So that will probably have been out by the time people are listening to this. Yeah, we talked about that show and that tour, still like a crucial tour in the Overkill history. And I remember actually them having some staging. They had like scrims, which was unusual at the time, and they had a little drum riser, which was, of course, way out in front of Dave Lombardo's drum riser.
Oh, yeah.
But it had like the Overkill logo that would light up. And of course, I had no idea back then, but I found out years later that they built all of that shit themselves.
Well, scrims are a really great way to have stage stuff without having to clutter, you know, to have to rent a truck or something like that. You know, yeah. It's like they roll up into nothing. They're tiny.
Yeah, they roll up into nothing and they can cover up. It's a lot easier than bringing a bunch of dummy cabs.
Right, exactly.
Pretend you have giant stacks.
I still can't believe people do that. It's like, come on, guys. If you're going to bring them, have speakers in them and run them. But yeah. Whatever.
Otherwise,
I mean, I get it. Yeah. It's theater. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a show. You're putting on a show, and that's so I get it. But I mean, we're that's not our style, you know.
Yeah.
Speaking of Dave Lombardo, I remember seeing him at the Casbah in San Diego in the late '90s with Fantomas, and he brought his I don't know if you're familiar with the Casbah in San Diego, but it's a very small club.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe 200 cap, something like that. And, you know, I mean, the stage is small as well, but he brought his whole drum kit, including gongs and shit, and he took up half the whole freaking stage. I was like, oh my God. It was awesome to be able to see that up close, you know, but I was like, not brought one floor tom. I don't know.
Is Mike Patton just like, on the floor?
You know, he's on the other side. All the rest of the band is on stage left, and Dave Lombardo is facing stage left, and he took up the entire stage right. It was fucking insane.
That's amazing.
But it was awesome. I mean, play. You
know? I mean, he's well known. One of my favorite drummers of all time. But yeah, but that is a little Spinal Tap, nevertheless. That's pretty awesome. But yeah, so other Metallica shows, what were... what stands out to you seeing them in the intervening years since that first time?
Well, we played that the Orion Music and More Festival in Jersey. And I think seeing them play, they were going to do the Black Album one night, and they were going to do Ride the Lightning the other night, and they didn't say which was which, because I don't think they wanted some, you know, people to be like, well, I'm not going to the, you know,
right,
that show or whatever. But we lucked out. The day we were there, it was Ride the Lightning.
And what's interesting is they did the Black Album backwards, I think, because, you know, they recognized, you know, you want to end with Sad But True and Inner Sandman. Like, so
well, that was
they
thing.
They cheated a little bit.
Well, they did the same with Ride the Lightning.
Oh, did they? Interesting. So they started with Cthulhu?
No, it was Fade to Black was the, I think, isn't that the end? Or no, is it Call of Cthulhu the last one?
Yeah.
Well, they reversed it, because, and I know this because I had a $5 bet with my friend that was there, and I was like, no way, they've got to play it front to back, because it's the album. You play the album. You know, right. People are going to be along for the ride.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't know, man. It's like, they probably want to end with, you know, like, with, what's the first track, Ride Lightning? Fight Fire with Fire, right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a perfect... Although I think they did some encore, so it really wouldn't have mattered. They could have played the thing front to back and then ended with some other hits. But anyway, so they do it backwards. I pay him his $5. He's like yeah. And then he's like, yeah, I was, because James Hetfield came backstage before we played our set, which I sort of browned out because I was like starstruck. That doesn't happen to me, but I was like, oh my God, it's fucking James Hetfield.
Oh, this is the place to talk about it, by the way. This is literally what this podcast is. So
okay.
Feel free to elaborate on every detail.
Yeah. Well, when we booked that, we got booked for that show. We were told that it was curated by Metallica and that all the bands were picked by the band members. Anyway, we were like, well, this is a great opportunity, but I'll believe that they curated, or that Metallica's heard our band when I meet them face to face.
Right.
I just don't fucking believe it. Anyway, so we get there and it was like, I don't know, 10 minutes before our set, and our tour manager comes up to us and says, guys, stand right here. James Hetfield's dude is says that James wants to meet you, so he wants you all wrangled someplace so he can just walk over.
Wow.
We're like, okay. And so he shows up, and I'm like, holy shit, that is James Hetfield. It's crazy. And I don't really even remember talking to him, but I do remember punching him on the shoulder. And I'm like, you just punched James Hetfield. What are you doing, you idiot? But anyway, but, you know, I just...
Yeah,
all
of a sudden it's just the Chris Farley show, right? Like, Remember when you played an Explorer every day? That was cool. Yeah.
That was just, if I was that articulate, I'd be impressed. But anyway, so after I'm paying off the $5 for the bet, he's like, yeah, it's crazy. When James Hetfield was side stage, I asked him whether you guys, I told him about our bet. And he didn't tell me what they were gonna do, but I told him about it. I'm like, man, I'm let $5 back. You influenced the bet. It's like insider trading or something. But anyway, no, I didn't actually take the $5 back. It was fine. But anyway, it was just funny. I was like, man, you can't do that. But yeah, that was incredible. And just seeing them do all those songs was so great, because I mean, I think that they're a great band, but you know, they're discographies, not everything it grabs me, you know.
Sure.
I think like Load and Reload weren't, you know, they just weren't, I don't think they were written for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Obviously millions of record sales, it's like there's an audience for it. So
yeah.
But just to get to see all those songs that were just so influential to me, you know, that, you know, really inspired me to play guitar and do music, you know, it was a big moment, you know. And also just how crazy to think, like, I played vaguely near Metallica. It's amazing, you know?
Metallica adjacent. Yeah,
I was a Metallica adjacent. Yes,
at the second Orion Music that they did, the one in Michigan, I was the manager for Dillinger Escape Plan and also the band All Shall Perish, and both bands, you know, got asked to do Orion, and, you know, Metallica being my favorite band of all time, and, you know, Greg being one of my best friends, and it was just like the whole, there was just so much about it that was just such a, like, goosebumps, and I was like, of course I'm going, you know. It's, as a manager, it's not often that a band is on a festival, and I'm like, oh, I better go out to that festival, but in that case, I'm like, oh, do you guys, should I just TM both bands, or? Yeah, it was really cool, because Kirk actually came out and introduced All Shall Perish, and then Rob Trujillo came out and introduced Dillinger, and it's just like, man, I mean, you know, could they be any more giving and awesome?
Oh, yeah, incredible. Yeah, James Hetfield introduced us, and I was like, what is happening? I feel like I'm going to bizarro world of Star Trek episode or something, you know.
Oh, you buried the lead, by the way. You didn't mention that part. He introduced you. You buried your lead. You didn't tell me that Hetfield introduced you.
Oh, he did. Yes. And the other fun fact is that I'm not going to say who in the band, but one of us was in drop D and the first song was in E. So the first song, well, you can imagine it was a whole step off. So I remember looking over going, no, and seeing James Hetfield side stage. And I'm like, he has got to be so disappointed in us. I mean, we said, you know, we had seven more songs to recover and it went just fine. But I was like, oh, no.
You know, oh, man.
But another thing I'll say about Metallica, which I and that festival is just what how cool the variety in bands, you know, there were. It was like they had the Hot Snakes, which is, you know, I love the Hot Snakes. They're one of my favorite bands. But it's just doesn't, I don't, you know, and I was watching them and it was like, you know, there was a crowd for them, but it's like, this is not necessarily Metallica, you know, devotee.
No. And I think
style, you know,
and I think the like, one you did had like the Arctic Monkeys on it too, right?
I think so. Yeah. And, who else? Oh, Rocky Erickson, who recently right. passed away.
Yeah. Rest in peace.
Yeah. I mean, that guy was what an amazing free spirited, you know, man, that dude's brain was beyond everybody, you know, and just to be able to see all these different cool bands. And it was like, you know, to some degree, you know, in the, I don't know, in the, you know, late 90s or whatever, what I felt like personally, I felt like Metallica had sort of lost their way musically. And honestly, recently, I feel like some of their newer albums have actually kind of come back to, you know, their roots, and I'm really happy about that. But just that it just really spoke to me that they would have such varying and good taste in bands was really impressive to me. I was like, no way, Rocky Erickson, fucking Hot Snakes, you know, Black Tusk. There was just all these. It was really cool. So anyway, it was sort of du jour to kind of trash talk, you know, their modern songwriting for a while there. But I don't really have a bad word to say about that band.
No way. When you are putting on your instrument and you're warming up, if there are Metallica riffs coming out of your hands, what are the most common ones?
Oh, Jesus. I'm not that good a guitar player. Yeah, I mean, for Who the Bell Tolls, I can sort of muddle my way through that, but it's so bad that I just don't even really, I don't even try. yeah, you know, like David is our other guitar player is, mm-hmm. is very adept at picking things up by ear and playing songs. That's just not me. I'm very. I've got to see somebody do it and it's got to be shown to me. I've been playing guitar for quite a while, so I guess I'm getting better at it, but yeah, it's just really not my, it's not really my thing.
There is, I think it's just sort of, I don't know that one way is better or worse than any other. I think it's just a different type of feel and a different type of brain even that, some people are just like you described, and I don't think there's anything bad about it. And then other people, yeah, are just like they pick up something by ear immediately. Or, you know, I have a good friend of mine who is a ripping, shredding guitar player, and he just taught himself piano and keyboards basically over the last couple of months. You know, you're just like, wait, what? And then you're also then you're also like, of course you did. You know? Like,
oh, no, I don't hate them, but I do kind of. It's just like, totally. Man, it comes to you so easily. It's like, man, playing music never came easy to me. I mean, I played piano when I was a kid, and it was a real struggle for me. You know, I mean, I picked it up, but I'm not good at piano, I'll tell you that. If someone asked me to, you know, play a piece on the piano, I would it would be chopsticks, you know. I mean, I haven't played piano seriously in like 30 years, so
yeah, I can I can play the beginning of the theme from Jaws. That's about it.
Oh yeah, yeah. Dun, 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 dun. You know, I guess that's my other go-to.
there's a great story about that where apparently when John Williams played it for Spielberg for the first time on a piano, Spielberg thought he was joking.
Oh really?
Here's the theme for the movie. Dun 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 dun. He's like, he thought he was kidding.
Well, it's crazy, and now it's one of the most iconic soundtracks of movies in general.
Absolutely. You know, coming off of the heels of Only Ghosts, which is what was that, 2016?
I believe that's true.
What's 2019 looking like for Red Fang?
What's well, we're heading into the studio on Monday. We're going to start tracking.
Oh wow!
For a next full length. Yes, we have 10 days booked, and then slammed up against a short tour, like a 2-week tour in Europe. Then we come home. We got 6 or 7 songs ready to roll, and so we'll try to get most of the basic tracking done. Maybe. I don't know. I'll be optimistic and say we'll get some overdubs and vocals done, so they'll be in a place where we can listen to them and sort of ruminate. And then once we get home in July, we will hunker back down and try to come up with another 6 or 7 so that we'll have some extra material. I'll try to have like an 11-song album out in 2020 or 19. What the hell year is it?
2019? It's 19, but we're already halfway over, which is wild.
Okay, yeah. So we're shooting for a spring release of a new LP. If you haven't seen it, we have a pretty fun new video out that is a new single, which is an interactive thing where you have to headbang to listen to the song. Mm-hmm. which I have yet to finish. I've cheated and finished it, but actually playing it, I haven't done it yet, which is embarrassing because I'm in the damn band. But anyway, it's really challenging, and you know, it's fun, and so I guess that's the thing. We're gonna release that single in the next week or two, so you don't have to break your neck to listen to it; you can just listen to it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I like that idea of actually breaking up the writing and recording process, because then you guys will be able to kind of sit with what you track in the first chunk, and you know, I don't know. I think that's an interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, it's very different. Well, than our last recording where we went down to Ross Robinson has a house down in Venice mm-hmm. Beach, and he has a small studio in his basement, and we were in there. I think it was 31 days straight. We were doing, I mean, not constantly, but they were 10 to 12 hour days every day for 31 days. And we, you know, he put us up. So we were living there and no days off, just wake up, have coffee and just go. which I think was great. This is going to be way more relaxed because we're at home. And it is a luxury to be able to record some stuff and then kind of think on what you've done so far and see what maybe you want to change for the next group of songs or how you might want to go about even, you know, writing the next group of songs. You know, it's like I say, you know, we're lucky to have that time available. We're recording with Ross or recording with Chris Funk again. Mm. That was my next question.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did, oh my God, Whales and Leeches and Murder the Mountains with us here in Portland. So to return to that, it was a cool process working with him. So I'm looking forward to it. And now he's running the studio called Halfling, which is a really expansive, really, really nice, studio. A lot of amenities, and having a lot of space to work in and being close to home.
To have the studio experience, but also get to sleep in your own bed is kind of the best of both worlds.
Exactly. I mean, I guess you could look at it both ways. I mean, to some degree, just being kind of buried in it and being away from home and not having any kind of distractions, you know, you're not worried if the iron's on at home. You know, when we were at Ross's, it was just like, no, this is nose to the grindstone, you know, which was, you know, arduous to some degree, but also, you know, it paid off. So,
yeah.
So I guess you can.
And also at Ross's, you get to hang out with Carl the dog. Don't forget about
yes.
that.
Yes. Carl's a good goddamn dog.
He's a pretty good dog.
Well, that's what he would, Ross would say that, like, I don't know, four times a day. Carl, you're a good goddamn dog.
So, yeah, so you guys tracked with Ross last time, and Joe Barisi mixed it. Do you have any thoughts on who's going to be mixing this time, or are you not quite there yet?
Funk is going to mix.
Oh,
so
cool.
It's going to be all in
mixed.
House,
yeah, awesome. Well, dude, from one Ryan to a Brian, this has been a fantastic and fun and engaging conversation, and for that I am very appreciative.
And for my part, I enjoyed the conversation. I hope that I haven't alienated or irritated too many people today. But Red Fang loves you.
Red Fang loves you. Are you alive? How does it feel to be alive? The Red Fang family loves you. That does it for this episode of Speak and Destroy. Keep up with all things Red Fang at redfang.net. Keep up with the podcast at speakanddestroy.com. Follow us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. Check out past episodes, and please, please, if you're listening to this, particularly in Apple Podcasts, write a nice little review and leave a 5-star rating, because those really help with visibility for the podcast and people discovering it more and more all the time. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. Check out other podcasts like Hoosier Illusion, No Prize from God, and Pop Curse. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.